From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Fearful Rock by Manly Wade Wellman. Enid Mandifer tried to stand up under what she had just heard. She managed it, but her ears rang, her eyes misted. She felt as if she were drowning. The voice of Purcell Mandifer came through the fog, level and slow, with a hint of that foreign accent which nobody could identify. "Now that you know that you are not really my daughter, perhaps you are curious as to why I adopted you." Curious? Was that the word to use? But this man, who was not her father after all, he delighted in understatements. Enid's eyes had grown clearer now. She was able to move to obey Purcell Mandifer's invitation to seat herself. She saw him, half sprawling in his rocking chair against the plastered wall of the parlor, under the painting of his ancient friend Aaron Burr. Was the rumor true, she mused, that Burr had not really died, that he still lived and planned ambitiously to make himself a throne in America? But Aaron Burr would have had to be an old man, 100 years old, or more than 100. Purcell Mandifer's own age might have been anything, but probably he was nearer 70 than 50. Physically, he was the narrowest of men, in shoulders, hips, temples, and legs alike, so that he appeared distorted and compressed. White hair, like comb thistle down, fitted itself in ordered streaks to his high skull. His eyes, dull and dark as musket balls, peered expressionlessly above the nose like a stiletto, the chin like the pointed toe of a fancy boot. The fleshlessness of his own legs was accentuated by tight trousers strapped under the instep. At his throat sprouted a frill of lace after a fashion 25 years old. At his left, on a stool, crouched his enormous son, LaRue. LaRue's body was a collection of soft-looking globes and bladders, a tremendous belly, round-kneed short legs, puffy hands, a gross bald head between fat shoulders. His white linen suit was only a shade paler than his skin, and his loose, faded pink lips moved incessantly. Once Enid had heard him talking to himself, had been close enough to distinguish the words. Over and over he had said, "I'll kill you, I'll kill you, I'll kill you." These two men had reared her from babyhood. Here in this low, spacious manor of brick and timber in the Ozark country, 16 or 18 years ago, there had been Indians hereabouts, but they were gone, and the few settlers were on remote farms. The Mandifers dwelt alone with their servants, who were usually solemn and taciturn. Purcell Mandifer was continuing. "I have brought you up as a gentleman would bring up his real daughter, for the sole and simple end of making a good wife." "That explains, my dear, the governess, the finishing school at St. Louis, the books, the journeys we have undertaken to New Orleans and elsewhere. I regret that this distressing war between the states," and he paused to draw from his pocket his enameled snuff-box, "should have made recent junkets impractical. However, the time has come, and you are not to be despised. Your marriage is now to befall you." "Marriage?" mumbled LaRue, in a voice that Enid was barely able to hear. His fingers interlaced like fat white worms in a jumble. His eyes were for Enid, his ears for his father. Enid saw that she must respond. She did so. "You have chosen a husband for me?" Purcell Mandifer's lips crawled into a smile, very wide on his narrow blade of a face, and he took a pinch of snuff. "Your husband, my dear, was chosen before ever you came into this world," he replied. The smile grew broader, but Enid did not think it cheerful. "Does your mirror do you justice?" he teased her. "Enid, my foster daughter, does it tell you truly that you are a beauty with a face all lustrous and oval, eyes full of tender fire, a cascade of golden brown curls to frame the whole?" His gaze wandered upon her body, and his eyelids drooped. "Does it convince you, Enid, that your figure combines rarely those traits of fragility and rondure that are never so desirable as when they occur together? Ah, Enid, had I myself met you or one like you 30 years ago?" "Father," growled Leroux as though at sacrilege. Percel Manifer chuckled. His left hand, white and slender with a dark cameo upon the forefinger, extended and patted Leroux's repellent bald pate in superior affection. "Never fear, son," crooned Percel Manifer. "Enid shall go a pure bride to him who waits her." His other hand crept into the breast of his coat and drew forth something on a chain. It looked like a crucifix. "Tell me," pleaded the girl. "Tell me, she broke off, for she could not call him father. "What is the name of the one I am to marry?" "His name," said Leroux, as though aghast at her ignorance. "His name," repeated the lean man in the rocking chair. The crucifix-like object in his hands began to swing idly and rhythmically while he paid out chain to make its pendulum motion wider and slower. "He has no name." Enid felt her lips grow cold and dry. "He has no..." "He is the nameless one," said Percel Manifer, and she could discern the capital letters in the last two words he spoke. "Look," said Leroux, out of the corner of his weak mouth that was nearest his father. "She thinks that she is getting ready to run." "She will not run," assured Percel Manifer. "She will sit and listen and watch what I have here in my hand." The object on the chain seemed to be growing in size and clarity of outline, and it felt that it might not be a crucifix after all. "The nameless one is also ageless," continued Percel Manifer. "My dear, I dislike telling you all about him, and it is not really necessary. All you need know is that we, my fathers and I, have served him here and in Europe since the days when France was Gaul. Yes, and before that." The swinging object really was increasing in her sight, and the basic cross was no cross, but a three-armed thing like a capital T. Nor was the body-like figure spiked to it. It seemed to twine and clamber upon that T-shape like a monkey on a bracket. Like a monkey, it was grotesque, disproportionate, a mockery. That climbing creature was made of gold or of something gilded over. The T-shaped support was as black and bright as jet, and it thought that the golden creature was dull, as if tarnished, and that it appeared to move, an effect created perhaps by the rhythmic swinging on the chain. "Our profits from the association have been great," Percel Manifer droned. "Yet we have given greatly. 4 times in each 100 years must a bride be offered." Mist was gathering once more in Enid's eyes and brain, a thicker mist than the one that had come from the shock of hearing that she was an adopted orphan. Yet through it all she saw the swinging device, the monkey-like climber upon the tee, and through it all she heard Manifer's voice. "When my real daughter, the last female of my race, went to the Nameless One, I wondered where our next bride would come from. And so, 20 years ago, I took you from a foundling asylum at Nashville." It was becoming plausible to her now. There was a power to be worshipped, to be feared, to be fed with young women. She must go. No, this sort of belief was wrong. It had no element of decency in it. It was only beaten into her by the spell of the pendulum's swinging charm. Yet she had heard certain directions, orders as to what to do. "You will act in the manner I have described and say the things I have repeated tonight at sundown," Manifer informed her, as though from a great distance. "You will surrender yourself to the Nameless One, as it was ordained when first you came into my possession." "No," she tried to say, but her lips would not even stir. Something had crept into her, a will not her own, which was forcing her to accept defeat. She knew she must go. Where? To Fearful Rock, said the voice of Mandifer, as though he had heard and answered the question she had not spoken. Go there, to that house where once my father lived, and worship that house, which upon the occasion of his rather mysterious death I left. It is now our place of devotion and sacrifice. Go there, Enid, tonight at sundown, in the manner I have prescribed. 2. The Cavalry Patrol. Lieutenant Kane Lanark was one of those strange and vicious heritage anomalies of one of the most paradoxical of wars. A war where a great Virginian was high in northern command, and a great Pennsylvanian stubbornly defended one of the South's principal strongholds. Where the two presidents were both born in Kentucky, indeed within scant miles of each other. Where father strove against son and brother against brother, even more frequently and tragically than in all the jangly verses and Faustian dramas of the day. Lanark's birthplace was a Maryland farm, moderately prosperous. His education had been completed at the Virginia Military Institute, where he was one of a very few who were inspired by a quiet, bearded professor of mathematics, who later became the Stonewall of the Confederacy, perhaps the continent's greatest tactician. The older Lanark was strongly for states' rights and mildly for slavery, though he possessed no chattels. Kane, the younger of two sons, had carried those same attitudes with him as much as 7 miles past the Kansas border, whither he had gone in 1861 to look for employment and adventure. At that lonely point he met with southern guerrillas, certain loose-shirted, weapon-laden gentry, whose leader, a gaunt young man with large, worried eyes, bore the craggy name of Quantrill and was to be called by a later historian the bloodiest man in American history. Young Kane Lanark, surrounded by sudden leveled guns, protested his sympathy with the South by birth, education, and personal preference. Quantrill replied rather sententiously that while this might be true, Lanark's horse and money belt had a Yankee look to them and would be taken as prisoners of war. After the guerrillas had galloped away, with a derisive laugh hanging in the air behind them, Lanark trudged back to the border and a little settlement, where he begged a ride by freight wagon to St. Joseph, Missouri. There he enlisted with a Union cavalry regiment just then in the forming, and his starkness of manner with evidence about him of military education and good sense caused his fellow recruits to elect him a sergeant. Later that year, Lanark rode with patrol through southern Missouri, where fortune brought him and his comrades face to face with Quantrill's guerrillas, the same that had plundered Lanark. The lieutenant in charge of the Federal cavalry set a most historical example for flight and died of 6 southern bullets placed accurately between his shoulder blades. But Lanark, as ranking non-commissioned officer, rallied the others, succeeded in withdrawing them in order before the superior force. As he rode last of the retreat, he had the fierce pleasure of engaging and sabering an overzealous guerrilla who had caught up with him. The patrol rejoined its regiment with only 2 loss. The colonel was pleased to voice congratulations, and Sergeant Lanark became Lieutenant Lanark. Vice the slain officer. In April of 1862, General Curtis, recently the victor in the desperately fought Battle of Pea Ridge, showed trust and understanding when he gave Lieutenant Lanark a scouting party of 20 picked riders with orders to seek yet another encounter with the marauding Quantrill. Few Union officers wanted anything to do with Quantrill, but Lanark, remembering his harsh treatment at those avaricious hands, yearned to kill the guerrilla chieftain with his own proper sword. On the afternoon of April 5th, beneath a sun bright but none too warm, the scouting patrol rode down a trail at the bottom of a great trough-like valley just south of the Missouri-Arkansas border. 2 pairs of men, those with the surest-footed mounts, acted as flanking parties high on the opposite slopes, and a watchful corporal by the name of Guggen walked his horse well in advance of the main body. The others rode 2 and 2 with Lanark at the head and Sergeant Yeager, heavy-set and morosely keen of eye, at the rear. A photograph survives of Lieutenant Kane Lanark as he appeared that very spring, his breadth of shoulder and slimness of waist, accentuated by the snug blue cavalry jacket that terminated at his sword belt, his ruddy beak-nosed face shaded by a wide black hat with a gold cord. He wore a mustache trim but not gay, and his long chin alone of all his command went smooth-shaven. To these details be it added that he rode his bay gelding easily, with a light, sure hand on the reins, and that he had the air of one who knew his present business. The valley opened at length upon a wide level platter of land among high, pine-tufted hills. The vast expanse was no more than half-timbered, though clever enemies might advance unseen across if they had exercised caution and foresight enough to slip from one belt of clump of trees to the next. Almost at the center of the level, a good 5 miles from where Lanark now halted his command, stood a single great chimney or finger of rock, its lean tip more than twice the height of the tallest tree within view. To this geologic curiosity, the eyes of Lieutenant Lanark snapped at once. "Sergeant," he called, and Jaeger saddled his horse close. "We'll head for that rock and stop there," Lanark announced. "It's a natural watchtower, and from the top of it we can see everything. Even better than we could if we rode clear across flat ground to those hills. And if Quantrill is west of us, which I'm sure he is, I'd like to see him coming a long way off, so as to know whether to fight or run." "I agree with you, sir," said Jaeger. He peered through narrow, puffy lids at the pinnacle and gnawed his shaggy lower lip. "I shall lift up mine eyes unto the rocks from whence cometh my help," he misquoted reverently. The sergeant was full of garbled scripture, and the men called him Bible. Jaeger behind that wide back of his. This did not mean that he was soft, dreamy, or easily fooled. Curtis had chosen him as sagely as he had chosen Lanark. Staying in the open as much as possible, the party advanced upon the rock. They found it standing above a soft grassy hollow, which in turn ran eastward. From the base of the rock to a considerable ravine dark and full of timber. As they spread out to the approach, they found something else. A house stood in the hollow, shadowed by the great pinnacle. "It looks deserted, sir," volunteered Jaeger at Lanark's brittle elbow. "No sign of life." "Perhaps," said Lanark. "Deploy the men, and we'll close in from all sides. Then you, with one man, enter the back door. I'll take another and enter the front." "Good, sir." The sergeant kneed his horse into a faster walk, passing from one to another of the three corporals with muttered orders. Within 60 seconds, the patrol closed upon the house like a 20-fingered hand. Lanark saw that the building had once been pretentious. 2 stories, stoutly made of good lumber, that must have been carted from a distance, with shuttered windows and a high-peaked roof. Now it was a paint-starved gray, with deep veins and traceries of dirty black upon its clapboards. He dismounted before the piazza with its 4 pillar-like posts, and threw his reins to a trooper. "Suggs," he called, and obediently, his own personal orderly, a plump blond youth, dropped out of the saddle. Together they walked up on the resounding planks of the piazza. Lanark, his ungloved right hand swinging free beside his holster, knocked at the heavy front door with his left fist. There was no answer. He tried the knob, and after a moment of shoving, the hinges creaked, and the door went open. They walked into a dark front hall, then into a parlor with dust upon the rug and the fine furniture and rectangles of pallor upon the walls where pictures had once hung for years. They could hear echoes of every movement, as anyone will hear in a house to which he is not accustomed. Beyond the parlor, they came to an ornate chandelier with crystal pendants, and at the rear stood a sideboard of dark, hard wood. Its drawers all hung half open, as if the silver and linen had been hastily removed. Above it hung plate racks, also empty. Feet sounded in a room to the rear, and then Jaeger's voice, asking if his lieutenant were inside. Lanark met him in the kitchen, conferred, then together they mounted the stairs in the front hall. Several musty bedrooms, darkened by closed shutters, occupied the second floor. The beds had dirty mattresses, but no sheets or blankets. "All clear in the house," pronounced Lanark. "Jaeger, go and detail a squad to reconnoiter in that little ravine east of here. We want no rebel sharpshooters sneaking up on us from that point. Then leave a picket there, put a man on top of the rock, and guard at the front and rear of this house, and have some of the other police up the house itself. We may stay here for 2 days, even longer." The sergeant saluted, then went to bellow his orders, and troopers dashed hither and thither to obey. In a moment the sound of sweeping arose from the parlor. Lanark, to whom it suggested spring-cleaning, sneezed at the thought of the dust, then gave Suggs directions about the care of his bay. Unbuckling his saber, he hung it upon the saddle, but his revolver he retained. "You're in charge, Jaeger," he called, and sauntered away toward the wooded cleft. His legs needed the exercise. He could feel them straightening by degrees after their long clamping to his saddle flaps. He was uncomfortably dusty, too, and there must be water at the bottom of the ravine. Walking into the shade of the trees, he heard, or fancy he heard, a trickling sound. The slope was steep here, and he walked fast to maintain an easy balance upon it, for a minute and then two. There was water ahead all right, for it gleamed through the leafage, and something else gleamed, something pink. That pinkness was certainly flesh. His right hand dropped quickly to his revolver, and he moved forward carefully. Stooping, he took advantage of the bushy cover, at the same time avoiding a touch that might snap or rustle the foliage. He could hear a voice now, soft and rhythmic. Lanark frowned. A woman's voice? His right hand still at his weapon, his left caught and carefully drew down a spray of willow. He gazed into an open space beyond. It was a woman, all right, within 20 yards of him. She stood, ankle deep in a swift, narrow rush of brook water, and her fine body was nude, every graceful curve of it, with a cascade of golden brown hair falling and floating about her shoulders. She seemed to be praying, but her eyes were not lifted. They stared at a hand mirror that she held up to catch the last flash of the setting sun. 3. The image in the cellar. Lanark, a young, serious-minded bachelor in an era when women swaddled themselves inches deep in fabric, had never seen such a sight before, and to his credit be it said that his first and strongest emotion was proper embarrassment for the girl in the stream. He had a momentary impulse to slip back and away. Then he remembered that he had ordered a patrol to explore this place. It would be here within moments. Therefore he stepped into the open, wondering at the time, as well as later, if he did well. "Miss," he said gently, "Miss, you'd better put your things on, my men." She stared, squeaked in fear, dropped the mirror, and stood motionless. Then she seemed to gather herself for flight. Lanark realized that the trees beyond her were thick and might hide enemies, that she was probably a resident of this rebel-inclined region and might be a decoy for such as himself. He whipped out his revolver, holding it at the ready but not pointing it. "Don't run," he warned her sharply. "Are those your clothes beside you? Put them on at once." She caught up a dress of flowered calico and fairly flung it on over her head. His embarrassment subsided a little, and he came another pace or two into the open. She was pushing her feet, very small feet they were, into heelless shoes. Her hands quickly gathered up some underthings and wadded them into a bundle. She gazed at him apprehensively, questioningly. Her hastily donned dress remained unfastened at the throat, and he could see the panicky stir of her heart in her half-bared bosom. "I'm sorry," he went on, "but I think you'd better come up to the house with me." "House?" she repeated fearfully, and her dark white eyes turned to look beyond them. Plainly she knew which house he meant. "You live there?" "I'm staying there at this time." "You came for me?" Apparently she had expected someone to come. But instead of answering, he put a question of his own. "To whom were you talking just now? I could hear you." I said the words, my fate." She broke off wretchedly, and Lanark was forced to think how pretty she was in her confusion. "The words that Purcell Mandefer told me to say." Her eyes on his, she continued softly, "I came to meet the Nameless One. Are you the Nameless One?" "I am certainly not nameless," he replied. "I am Lieutenant Lanark of the Federal Army of the Frontier, at your service." He bowed slightly, which made it more formal. "Now come along with me." He took her by the wrist, which shook in his big left hand. Together they went back eastward through the ravine in the direction of the house. Before they reached it, she told him her name, and that the big natural pillar was called Fearful Rock. She also assured him that she knew nothing of Quantrill and his guerrillas, and a fourth item of news shook Lanark to his spurred heels, the first non-military matter that had impressed him in more than a year. An hour later, Lanark and Yeager finished an interview with her in the parlor. They called Suggs, who conducted the young woman up to one of the bedrooms. Then Lieutenant and Sergeant faced each other. The light was dim, but each saw bafflement and uneasiness in the face of the other. "Well?" challenged Lanark. Yeager produced a clasp knife, opened it, and peered thoughtfully at a thumbnail. "I'll take my oath," he ventured, "that Miss Enid Mandefer is telling the gospel truth." "Truth?" exploded Lanark scornfully. "Mountain folk ignorance, I call it. Nobody believes in those devil things these days." "Oh yes, somebody does," said Yeager, mildly but definitely. "I do." He put away his knife and fumbled within his blue army shirt. "Look here, Lieutenant." It was a small book he held out, little more than a pamphlet in size and thickness. On its cover of gray paper appeared a smudged woodcut of an owl against a full moon in the title, "John George Homan's Powwows or Long Lost Friend." "I got it when I was a young lad in Pennsylvania," explained Yeager, almost reverently. "Lots of Pennsylvania people carry this book as I do." He opened the little volume and read from the back of the title page. "Whosoever carries this book with him is safe from all his enemies, visible or invisible. And whoever has this book with him cannot die without the holy corpse of Jesus Christ, nor drown in any water, nor burn up in any fire, nor can any unjust sentence be passed upon him." Lanark put out his hand for the book, and Yeager surrendered it somewhat hesitantly. "I've heard of supposed witches in Pennsylvania," said the officer. "Hexes, I believe they're called. Is this a witch book?" "No, sir. Nothing about black magic. See the cross on that page? It's a protection against witches." "I thought that only Catholics used the cross," said Lanark. "No, not only Catholics." Lanark passed the thing back. "Superstition, I call it. Nevertheless, you speak this much truth. That girl is in earnest. She believes what she told us. Her father or stepfather or whoever he is sent her up here on some ridiculous errand, perhaps a dangerous one." He paused. "Or I may be misjudging her. It may be a clever scheme, Yeager. A scheme to get a spy in among us." The sergeant's big bearded head wagged negation. "No, sir. If she was telling a lie, it'd be a more believable one, wouldn't it?" He opened his talisman book again. "If the lieutenant please, there's a charm in here against being shot or stabbed. It might be a good thing, seeing there's a war going on. Perhaps the lieutenant will like me to copy it out?" "No, thanks," Lanark drew forth his own charm against evil and nervousness, a leather case that contained cheroots. Yeager, who had convictions against the use of tobacco, turned away disapprovingly at a superior bit off the end of a fragrant brown cylinder and kindled the match. "Let me look at that what do you call it again," he requested, and for a second time Yeager passed the little volume over, then saluted and retired. Darkness was gathering early, what with the position of the house in the grassy hollow and the pinnacle of fearful rocks standing between it and the sinking sun to westward. Lanark called for Suggs to bring a candle, and when the orderly obeyed, directed him to take some kind of supper upstairs to Enid Mandefer. Left alone, the young officer seated himself in a newly dusted armchair of massive dark wood, emitted a cloud of blue tobacco smoke, and opened The Long-Lost Friend. It had no publication date, but John George Homan, the author, dated his preface from Berks County, Pennsylvania, on July 31, 1819, and the secondary preface, filled with testimonials as to the success of Homan's miraculous cures, was included the pious ejaculation, "The Lord bless the beginning and the end of this little work, and be with us that we may not misuse it, and thus commit a heavy sin." "Amen to that," said Lamarck to himself quite soberly. Despite his assured remarks to Yeager, he was somewhat repelled and nervous because of the things Enid Mandefer had told him. Was there then potentiality for such supernatural evil in this enlightened 19th century, even in the pages of the book he held? He read further and came upon a charm to be recited against violence and danger, perhaps the very one Jaeger had offered to copy for him. It began rather sonorously. "The peace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with me. O shot, stand still, in the name of the mighty prophets, Actian and Elias, and do not kill me." The narc remembered the name of Elias from his boyhood Sunday schooling. But Actaeon's identity as a prophet, or otherwise, escaped him. He resolved to ask Jaeger, and as though the thought had acted as a summons, Jaeger came almost running into the room. "Lieutenant, sir, lieutenant," he said hoarsely. "Yes, Sergeant Jaeger." Lenark rose, stared questioningly, and held out the book. Jaeger took it automatically, and as automatically stowed it inside his shirt. "I can prove, sir, that there's a real devil here," he mouthed unsteadily. "What?" demanded Lenark. "Do you realize what you're saying, man? Explain yourself." "Come, sir," Jaeger almost pleaded and led the way into the kitchen. "It's down in the cellar." From a little heap on a table, he picked up a candle and then opened a door full of darkness. The stairs to the cellar were shaky to Lenark's feet, and beneath him was solid black shadow, smelling strongly of damp earth. Jaeger stamping heavily ahead, looking backwards and forwards. That broad bearded face that had not lost its full-blooded flush in the hottest fighting at Pea Ridge had grown so pallid as almost to give off sickly light. Lenark began to wonder if all this theatrical approach would not make the promised devil seem ridiculous, anticlimactic, the flutter of an owl, the scamper of a rat, or something of that sort. "You have the candle, Sergeant," he reminded, and the echo of his voice momentarily startled him. "Strike a match, will you?" "Yes, sir." Jaeger had raised a knee to tighten his stripe-sided trousers. A snapping scrape, a burst of flame in the candle glow illuminated them both. It revealed, too, the cellar, walled with stones but floored with clay. As they finished the descent, Lenark could feel the soft grittiness of that clay under his boot soles. All around them lay rubbish, boxes, casks, stacks of broken pots and dishes, bundles of kindling. "Here," Jaeger was saying, "here is what I found." He walked around the foot of the stairs. Beneath the slope of the flight lay a long, narrow case made of plain, heavy boards. It was unpainted and appeared ancient. As Jaeger lowered the light in his hand, Lenark saw that the joinings were secured with huge nails, apparently forged by hand. Such nails had been used in building the older sheds on his father's Maryland estate. Now there was a creak of wooden protest as Jaeger pried up the loosened lid of the coffin-like box. Inside lay something long and ruddy. Lenark saw head and shoulders and started violently. Jaeger spoke again. "An image, sir, a heathen image." The light made grotesque the sergeant's face. One heavy, half fully illumined, the other secret and lost in the black shadow. "Look at it." Lenark too stooped for closer examination. The form was of human length, or rather more, but it was not finished, was neither divided into legs below nor extended into arms at the roughly shaped shoulders. The head, too, had been molded without features, though from either side, where the ears should have been, it sprouted up curved horns like a bison's. Lenark felt a chill creep upon him whence he knew not. "It's Satan's own image," Jaeger was mouthing deeply. "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." With one foot, he turned the coffin box upon its side. Lenark took a quick stride backward just in time to prevent the ruddy form from dropping out upon his toes. A moment later, Jaeger had spurned the thing. It broke with a crashing sound like crockery, and two more trampling kicks of the sergeant's heavy boots smashed it to bits. "Stop!" cried Lenark, too late. "Why did you break it? I wanted to have a good look at the thing." "But it is not good for men to look upon the devil's works," responded Jaeger, almost pontifically. "Don't advise me, Sergeant," said Lenark bleakly. "Remember that I am your officer, and that I don't need instructions as to what I may look at." He looked down at the fragments. The thing was hollow and quite brittle. It seems to have been stuffed with straw. No, excelsior. Wood shavings, anyway. He investigated the fluffy inner mass with a toe. "Lo, there's something inside of the stuff." "I wouldn't touch it, sir," warned Jaeger, but this time it was he who spoke. Too late. Lenark's boot toe had nudged the object into plain sight. and Lenark had put down his gauntlet left hand and picked it up. "What is this?" he asked himself aloud. "Looks rather like some sort of strongbox. Foreign, I'd say, and quite cold. Come on, Jaeger, we'll go upstairs." In the kitchen, with a strong light from several candles, they examined the find quite closely. It was a dark oblong, like a small dispatch case, or, as Lenark had commented, a strongbox. Though as hard as irons, it was not iron, nor any metal either of them had ever known. "How does it open?" was Lenark's next question, turning the case over in his hands. "It doesn't seem to have hinges on it. Is this the lid? Or this?"
"I couldn't say." Jaeger peered, his eyes growing narrow with perplexity.
"No hinges, as the lieutenant just said." "Invisible. Nor yet a lock." Lenark thumped the box experimentally and proved it hollow. Then he lifted it close to his ear and shook it. There was a faint rustle as of papers, loosely rolled or folded. "Perhaps," the officer went on, "this separate slice isn't a slice at all. There may be a spring to press or something that slides back and lets another plate come loose." But Suggs was entering from the front of the house.
"Lieutenant, sir, something's happened to Newton. He was watching on the rock. Will the lieutenant come and Sergeant Jaeger too?"
The suggestion of duty brought back the color and self-control that Jaeger had lost.
"What's happened to Newton?" he demanded at once, and hurried away with Suggs.
Lenark waited in the kitchen for only a moment. He wanted to leave the box, but did not want his troopers meddling with it. He spied beside the heavy iron stove a fireplace, and in its side the metal door to an old brick oven. He pulled that door open, thrust the box in, closed the door again, and followed Suggs and Jaeger. They had gone out upon the front porch. There, with Corporal Gray and a blank-faced trooper on guard, lay the silent form of Newton, its face covered with a newspaper. Almost every man of the gathered patrol knew a corpse when he saw one, and it took no second glance to know that Newton was quite dead. 4. The Mandifers. Jaeger, bending, lifted the newspaper and then dropped it back. He said something that, for all his religiosity, might have been an oath.
"What's the matter, Sergeant?" demanded Lenark.
Jaeger's brows were clamped in a tense frown, and his beard was actually trembling.
"His face, sir, it's terrible."
"A wound?" asked Lenark, and lifted the paper in turn. He too let it fall back, and his exclamation of horror and amazement was unquestionably profane.
"There ain't no wound on him, Lieutenant," Lenark offered Suggs, pushing his wan, plump face to the forefront of the troopers. "We heard Newton yell. Heard him from the top of the rock yonder."
All eyes turned gingerly toward the promontory.
"That's right, sir," added Corporal Gray. "I just sent Newton up to relieve Jossarand."
"You heard him yell?" prompted Lenark. "Go on, what happened?"
"I held him back," said the corporal, "but he said nothing. So I climbed up. The north side's the easiest to climb. Newton was standing at the top, standing straight up with his carbine at the ready. He must have been dead right then."
"You mean he was struck somehow as you watched?"
Gray shook his head. "No, sir, I think he was dead as he stood up. He didn't move or speak, and when I touched him, he sort of coiled down like an empty coat falling off a clothesline."
Gray's hand made a downward floating gesture in illustration.
"When I turned him over, I saw his face, all twisted and scared looking like what the lieutenant has seen. And I sung out for Suggs and McSween to come up and help me bring him down."
Lenark gazed at Newton's body.
"He was looking which way?"
"Over yonder, eastward."
Gray pointed unsteadily, "like it might have been beyond the draw and them trees in it."
Lenark and Jaeger peered into the waning light that was now dusk. Jaeger mumbled what Lenark had already been thinking, that Newton had died without wounds at or near the moment when the horned image had been shattered upon the cellar floor. Lenark nodded and dismissed several vague but disturbing inspirations.
"You say he died standing up, Gray?
Was he leaning on his gun?"
"No, sir. He stood on his 2 feet and held his carbine at the ready. Sounds impossible, a dead man standing up like that. But that's how it was."
"Bring his blanket and cover him up," said Lenark. "Put a guard over him, and we'll bury him tomorrow.
Don't let any of the men look at this face. We've got to give him some kind of funeral. He turned to Jaeger. Have you a prayer book, Sergeant? Jaeger had fished out the long-lost friend volume. He was reading something aloud as though it were a prayer. And be and remains with us on the water and upon the land, he pattered out. May the eternal Godhead also. Stop that heathen nonsense, Lamarck almost roared. You're supposed to be an example to the men, Sergeant. Put that book away. Jaeger obeyed, his big face reproachful. It was a spell against evil spirits, he explained. For a moment, Lamarck wished that he had waited for the end. He shrugged and issued further orders. I want all the lamps lighted in the house, and perhaps a fire out here in the yard, he told the men. We'll keep guard both here and in that gully to the east. If there is a mystery, we'll solve it. Pardon me, sir, volunteered a well-bred voice in which one felt rather than heard the tiny touch of foreign accent. I can solve the mystery for you, though you may not thank me. Two men had come into view, were drawing up beside the little knot of troopers. How had they approached? Through the patrolled brush of the ravine? Around the corner of the house? Nobody had seen them coming, and Lenark at least started violently. He glowered at this new enigma. The man who had spoken paused at the foot of the porch steps, so that lamplight shone upon him through the open front door. He was skeleton gaunt in face and body, and even his bones were small. His eyes burned forth from deep pits in his narrow, high skull, and his clothing was that of a dandy of the 40s. In his twig-like fingers he clasped bunches of herbs. His companion stood to one side in the shadow, and could be seen only as a huge, coarse lump of a man. I am Purcell Mandefer, the thin creature introduced himself. I came here to gather from the gardens, and he held out his handful of leaves and stalks. You, sir, you are in command of these soldiers, are you not? Then know that you are trespassing. The expediencies of war, replied Lenark easily, for he had seen Suggs and Corporal Gray bringing their carbines forward in their hands. You will have to forgive our intrusion. A scornful mouth opened in the emaciated face, and a soft superior chuckle made itself heard. Oh, but this is not my estate. I'm allowed here, yes, but it is not mine. The real master, the gaunt figure shrugged, and the voice paused for a moment. The bright eyes sought Newton's body. From what I see and what I heard as I came up to you, there has been trouble. You have transgressed somehow and have begun to suffer. To you Southerners, all Union soldiers are trespassers and transgressors, suggested Lenart, but the other laughed and shook his fleshless white head. You misunderstand, I fear. I care nothing about this war, except that I am amused to see so many people killed. I bear no part in it. Of course, when I came to pluck herbs and saw your sentry at the top of Fearful Rock, Purcell Mandefer eyed again the corpse of Newton. There he lies. It was my privilege and power to project a vision up to him in his loneliness that, I think, put an end to his part of this puerile strife. The narc's own face grew hard. Mr. Mandefer, he said bleakly, you seem to be enjoying a quiet laugh at our expense. But I should point out that we greatly outnumber you and are armed. I'm greatly tempted to place you under arrest. Then resist the temptation, advised Mandefer urbanely. It might be disastrous to you if we became enemies. Then be kind enough to explain what you're talking about, commanded Lenart. Something swam into the forefront of his consciousness. You say that your name is Mandefer. We found a girl named Enid Mandefer in the gully yonder. She told us a very strange story. Are you her stepfather? The one who mesmerized her aunt? She talked to you? Mandefer's soft voice suddenly lifted to a windy roar that broke Lenark's questioning abruptly in two. She came and did not make the sacrifice of herself? She shall expiate, sir, and you with her. Lenark had had enough of this high-handed civilian's airs. He made a motion with his left hand to Corporal Gray, whose carbine barrel glinted in the light from the house as it leveled itself at Mandefer's skull head. You're under arrest, Lenark informed the two men. The bigger one growled the first sound he had made. He threw his enormous body forward in a sudden leaping stride, his gross hands extended as though to clutch Lenark. Jaeger, at the lieutenant's side, quickly drew his revolver and fired from the hip. The enormous body fell, rolled over, and subsided. "You have killed my son!" shrieked Mandifer. "Take hold of him, you two," ordered Lenark, and Suggs and Jossarand obey. The gaunt form of Mandifer achieved one explosive struggle, then fell tautly motionless with the big hands of the troopers upon his elbows. "Thanks, Jaeger," continued Lenark. "That was done quickly and well. Some of you dragged his body up on the porch and cover it. Gray, tumble upstairs and bring down that girl we found." While waiting for the corporal to return, Lenark ordered further that a bonfire be built to banish a patch of the deepening darkness. It was beginning to shoot up its bright tongues as the corporal ushered Enid Mandifer out upon the porch. She had arranged her disordered clothing, had even contrived to put up her hair somehow, loosely but attractively. The firelight brought out a certain strength of line and angle in her face and made her eyes shine darkly. She was manifestly frightened at the sight of her stepfather and the blanket-covered corpse to one side, but she faced determinedly a flood of half-understandable invectives from the emaciated man. She answered him, too. Lenark did not know what she meant by most of the things she said, but gathered correctly that she was refusing finally and completely to do something. "Then I shall say no more," gritted out the spidery Mandifer, and his bare teeth were of the flat, chalky white of long-dead bone. "I place this matter in the hands of the Nameless One. He will not forgive, will not forget." Enid moved a step towards Lenark, who put out a hand and touched her arm reassuringly. The mounting flame of the bonfire lighted up all who watched and listened. The withered, glaring mummy that was Percel Mandifer, the frightened but defiant shapeliness of Enid in her flowered, patterned gown, Lenark in his sudden attitude of protection, the ring of troopers in their dusty blue blouses, with a half-lighted front of the weathered old house like a stage set behind them, and alternate red lights and sooty shadows playing over all, they might have been a tableau in some highly melodramatic opera. "Silence," Lenark was grating. "For the last time, Mr. Mandifer, let me remind you that I have placed you under arrest. If you don't calm down immediately and speak only when you're spoken to, I'll have my men tie you flat to four stakes and put a gag in your mouth." Mandifer subsided at once, just as he was on the point of hurling another harsh threat at Enid. "That's much better," said Lenark. "Sergeant Jaeger, it strikes me that we'd better get our pickets out to guard this position." Mandifer cleared his throat with actual diffidence. "Lieutenant Lenark, that is your name, I gather," he said in the soft voice which he had employed when he had first appeared. "Permit me, sir, to say but two words." He peered, as though to be of sure consent. "I have it in my mind that it is too late, useless to place any kind of guard against surprise." "What do you mean?" asked Lenark. "It is all of a piece with your offending of him who owns this house and the land which encompasses it," continued Mandifer. "I believe that a body of your enemies, mounted men of the southern forces, are upon you. That man died upon the brow of Fearful Rock might have seen them coming, but he was brought down sightless and voiceless, and nobody was assigned in his place." He spoke truth. Gray, in his agitation, had not posted a fresh sentry. Lenark drew his lips tight beneath his mustache. "Once more, you feel that it is a time to joke with us, Mr. Mandifer," he growled. "I've already suggested gagging you and staking you out." "But listen," Mandifer urged him. Suddenly hoofs thundered, men yelled, a double-noted defiance, high and savage. It was the rebel yell. Quantrill's guerrillas rode out of the dark and upon them. 5. Blood in the Night. Neither the Nark nor the others remembered that they began to fight for their lives. They only knew, all at once, that they were doing it. There was a prolonged, harsh rattle of gunshots like a blast of hail upon hard wood. Lenark, by chance or unconscious choice, snatched at and drew his sword instead of his revolver. A horse's flying shoulder struck him, throwing him backward but not down. As he reeled to save his footing, he saved also his own life, for the rider, a form all cascading black beard and slouch hat, thrust a pistol almost into the lieutenant's face and fired. The flash was blinding, the ball ripped Lenark's cheek like a whiplash, and then the saber in his hand swung, like a scythe reaping wheat. By luck rather than design, the edge hit the gorilla's gun wrist. Lanark saw the hand fly away as though on wings, its fingers still clutching the pistol, all agleam in the firelight. Blood gushed from the stump of the rider's right arm, like water from a fountain, and Lanark felt upon himself a spatter as of hot rain. He threw himself in, clutched the man's legs with his free arm, and as the body sagged heavily from above upon his head and shoulder, he heaved it clear out of the saddle. The horse was plunging and whinnying, but Lanark clutched its rein and got his foot into the stirrup. The bonfire seemed to be growing strangely brighter, and the mounted gorillas were plainly discernible, raging and trampling among his disorganized men. Corporal Gray went down, dying almost under Lanark's feet. Amid the deafening drum rolls of shots, Sergeant Yeager's bull-like voice could be heard. "Stop! Thieves and horsemen, in the name of God!" It sounded like an exorcism, as though the Confederate raiders were devils. Lanark had managed to climb into the saddle of his captured mount. He dropped the bridle upon his pommel, reached across his belly with his left hand, and dragged free his revolver. At a little distance beyond the tossing heads of several horses, he thought he saw the visage of Quantrill, clean-shaven and fierce. He fired at it, but he had no faith in his own left-handed snap-shooting. He felt the horse frantic and unguided, shoving and striving against another horse. Quarters were too close for a saber stroke, and he fired again with his revolver. The gorilla spun out of the saddle. Lanark had a glimpse he would never forget of a great bulging eyes and a sharp-pointed mustache. Again the rebel yell, flying from mouth to bearded mouth, and then an answering shout, deeper and more sustained. Some troopers had run out of the house, and standing on the porch were firing with their carbines. It was growing lighter with a blue light. Lanark did not understand that. Quantrill did not understand it either. He and Lanark had come almost within striking distance of each other, but the guerrilla chief was gazing past his enemy in the direction of the house. His mouth was open, with strained lines around it. His eyes glowed. He feared what he saw. "Remember me, you thieving swine!" yelled Lanark, and tried to thrust with a saber. But Quantrill had reined back and away, not from the sword, but from the light that was growing stronger and bluer. He thundered an order, something that Lanark could not catch, but which the gorillas understood and obeyed. Then Quantrill was fleeing. Some gorillas dashed between him and Lanark. They too were in flight. All the gorillas were in flight. Somebody roared in triumph and fired with a carbine. It sounded like Sergeant Yeager. The battle was over within moments of it beginning. Lanark managed to catch his reins in the tips of the fingers that held his revolver and brought the horse to a standstill before it followed Quantrill's men into the dark. One of his own party caught and held the bits, and Lanark dismounted. At last he had time to look at the house. It was a fire. Every wall and sill and timber of it burning all at once and completely, and it burned deep blue, as though seen through the glass of an old-fashioned bitters bottle. It was falling to pieces with a consuming heat, and they had to draw back from it. Lanark stared around to reckon his losses. Nearest the piazza lay three bodies, trampled and broken-looking. Some men ran in and dragged them out of danger. They were Purcell Mandifer, badly battered by horses' feet, and the two who had held him, Jossoran and Lanark's orderly, Suggs. Both the troopers had been shot through the head, probably at the first volley from the guerrillas. Corporal Gray was stone dead, with five or six bullets in him, and three more troopers had been killed, while four were wounded, but not critically. Yeager, examining them, pronounced that they could ride if the lieutenant wished it. "I wish it all right," said Lanark ruefully. "We leave first thing in the morning. Six dead and four hurt, not counting poor Newton, who's there in the fire. Half my command, and the way I forgot the first principles of military vigilance. I don't deserve as much luck as that. I think the burning house is what frightened the guerrillas. What began it?" Nobody knew. They had all been fighting too desperately to have any idea. The three men who had been picketing the gully and who had dashed back to assault the guerrillas on the flank had seen the blue flames burst out as if it were from 100 places. That was the best view anybody had. "All the killing wasn't done by Quantrill," Yeager comforted his lieutenant. 5 dead gorillas, sir. No, 6. One was picked up a little way off where he'd been dragged by his foot in the stirrup. Others got wounded, I'll be bound. Pretty even thing, all in all. And we still have one prisoner, supplemented Corporal Coogan. He jerked his head toward Enid Mandifer, who stood unhurt, unruffled almost, gazing raptly at the great geyser of blue flame that had been the house and temple of her stepfather's nameless deity. It was a gray morning, and from the first streaks of it, Sergeant Yeager had kept the unwounded troopers busy, making a trench-like grave halfway between the spot where the house had stood and the gully to the east. When the bodies were counted again, there were only 12. Purcell Mandifer's was missing, and the only explanation was that it had been caught somehow in the flames. The ruins of the house, that still smoked with a choking vapor as of sulfur gas, gave up a few crisp bones that apparently had been Newton, the sentry who had died from unknown causes. But no giant skeleton was found to remind one of the passing of Purcell Mandifer's son. No matter, said Lanark to Yeager. We knew that they were both dead and past our worrying about. Put the other bodies in, our men at this end, the guerrillas at the other. The order was carried out. Once again, Lanark asked about a prayer book. A lad by the name of Duncan said that he owned one, but that had been burned with the rest of his kit in the blue flame that destroyed the house. Then I'll have to do it from memory, decided Lanark. He drew up the surviving 10 men at the side of the trench. Yeager took a position beside him, and just behind the sergeant and did Mandifer stood. Lanark self-consciously turned over his clutter of thoughts, searching for odds and ends of the useful religious teachings. Man that is born of woman hath but short time to live, and is full of misery, he managed to repeat. He cometh up and is cut down like a flower. As he said the words, cut down, he remembered his saber stroke of the night before, and how he had shorn away a man's hand. That man with his heavy black beard lay in this trench before them, with the severed hand under him. Lanark was barely able to beat down a shudder. In the midst of life, he went on, we are in death. There he was obliged to pause. Sergeant Yeager, on inspiration, took one pace forward and threw into the trench a handful of gritty earth. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, remembered Lanark. Unto Almighty God we commit these bodies. He was sure that that was a misquotation worthy of Yeager himself, and made shift to finish with one more tag from his memory, in short and certain hope of the resurrection unto eternal life. He faced toward the file of men. 4 of them had been told to fall in under arms, and at his order they were raised their carbines and fired a volley into the air. After that, the trench was filled in. Yeager then cleared his throat and began to give orders concerning horses, saddles, and what possessions had been spared by the fire. Lanark walked aside and found Enid Mandifer keeping pace with him. "You are going back to your army?" she asked. "Yes, at once. I was sent here to see if I could find and damage Quantrill's band. I found him and gave at least as good as I got." "Thank you," she said, "for everything you've done for me." He smiled deprecatingly, and it hurt his bullet-burned cheek. "I did nothing," he protested, and both of them realized that it was the truth. "All that has happened, it just happened." He drew his eyes into narrow gashes as if brooding over the past 12 hours. "I'm halfway inclined to believe what your stepfather said about a supernatural influence here. But what about you, Miss Mandifer?" She tried to smile in turn, not very successfully. "I can go back to my home. I'll be alone there." "Alone?" "I have a few servants." "You'll be safe?" "As safe as anywhere." He clasped his hand behind him. "I don't know how to say it, but I have begun to feel responsible for you. I want to know that all will be well." "Thank you," she said a second time. "You owe me nothing." "Perhaps not. We do not know each other. We have spoken together only 3 or 4 times. Yet you will be in my mind. I want to make a promise." "Yes?" They had paused in a little stroll, almost beside the newly filled grave trench. Lanark was frowning, and Enid Mandifer nervous and expectant. "This war," he said weightily, "is going to last much longer than people thought at first. We, the Union, have done pretty well in the West here, but Lee is making fools of our generals back East. We may have to fight for years, and even then we may not win." "I hope, Mr. I mean, Lieutenant Lenark," stammered the girl. "I hope that you will live safely through it."
"I hope so, too. And if I am spared, if I am alive and well when peace comes, I swear that I shall return to this place. I shall make sure that you two are alive and well." He finished, very certain that he could not have used different, more stupid words. But Enid Mandifer smiled now, radiantly and gratefully. "I shall pray for you, Lieutenant Lenark. Now your men are ready to leave. Go, and I shall watch."
"No," he demurred. "Go yourself. Get away from this dreadful place." She bowed her head in assent and walked quickly away. At some distance she paused, turned, and waved her hand above her head. Lenark took off his broad black hat and waved in answer. Then he faced about, strode smartly back into the yard beside the charred ruins. Mounting his bay gelding, he gave the order to depart.